Before the Second World War, Winston Churchill worked for film producer Alexander Korda as screenwriter and historical advisor. The power of cinema later became a vital weapon in wartime. This is the story of a unique collaboration. An interview with Churchill.
Do you want to do it all again?
Well, it's just because of that thing, and it should look bad. And
I mean, it's all right for a film star, but I'm not that.
Scene six, take one.
Wait a moment.
We are the chosen few. I can't remember. I've got one of the best memories that you can have.
I know, sir, but that's quite all right. Quite all right. Don't worry. Look at the camera and start again, sir.
Winston Churchill has veered off into the world of motion pictures, signing a contract with London Films to write scenarios and assist in their production.
Now, try this. This is just an experiment with my voice.
Yes.
See, this is just all private. This.
Yes, quite so.
Mr. Churchill, scene seven, take one.
Churchill and the movie mogul.
I have an idea for a new article. Peter Pan, Township of the Films. Subtitle, Hollywood's Fantasy of Life. Here we enter a strange and amusing world, the like of which has certainly never been seen before. It's like going behind the scenes of a theatre, magnified by a thousandfold. Battalions of skilled workmen construct with magical quickness streets of London, of China, of India, jungles, mountains, and every conceivable form of scenery. In a neighboring creek, pirate ships, Spanish galleons, and Roman galleys ride at anchor.
Churchill, over the 20s, began to understand that it wasn't just writing books that was going to get you noticed. It was these two new media, the radio and cinema.
Churchill always aspired to work in the movies, and his style of writing, in many cases, was cinematic.
Churchill's sense of politics as a thing people could understand was to paint pictures. I mean, that great speech about what will happen if they invade. We will fight them on the beaches and, you know. You could make a movie from that speech.
We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be.
He had this adventurous attitude to life, that he'd take on anything if it appealed to his romantic nature.
Footage from the 1940 film The Thief of Baghdad, produced by Alexander Korda. A photo of Korda on set talking to the film's actors. Then a photo of Churchill using his hands as binoculars.
In 1934, Churchill's son, Randolph, introduced him to the film producer, Alexander Korda. The son of a Jewish farm manager from rural Hungary, Korda had risen from great poverty to become the most prominent figure in British cinema.
He's known, thanks to the last biography, as Britain's only movie mogul. Britain really hadn't seen anything like him. In 1931, 32, when he arrived, what he did was front page news, not just in the cinema papers, but in the national papers.
Churchill said to his wife, Clementine, I think Korda has a kind of genius for this sort of thing.
Later on in 1934, Korda signed up Churchill for a handsome sum.
They just want talent, these producers, they want talent. And a speechwriter and writer of histories like Churchill, even though he was unpopular in the early 30s, was a great call from Korda.
London Films, Big Ben, everything British. Korda, I think, is looking to belong, looking for figures in the establishment who can help him. So in some way, you get a sense of the two drifting towards each other.
A political refugee from the age of 25, Korda had been captured and imprisoned by Admiral Horthy's anti-Semitic Hungarian regime. He was released thanks to the last-minute efforts of his film star wife, Maria Korda. Having been born into a Hungarian Jewish family, under the name Sándor Kellner, he quickly began to reinvent himself,
ultimately adopting the anglicised Alexander and the image of a larger-than-life English gentleman.
Alex was tall, elegant. As soon as he came to England, he learned it was very important what tailor you went to. Winston Churchill smoked the biggest cigars, so he bought the same kind of cigar.
Churchill, to begin with, was himself an outsider. He was part of the establishment, but part of him was American, and part of him was a rebel against the establishment. And I think that he saw in Alex this extraordinary rebel thing of somebody who sees life from a different angle.
This is a difficult time for Churchill. He's in his wilderness years. No one in the government is listening to him. Yet he sees a danger.
Footage of Hitler saluting, then someone saying, "I hereby lay the foundation stone of the German Film Academy." The National Film Prize for 1934 and 1935 goes to Leni Riefenstahl for her film of the Nuremberg Party Conference, Triumph of the Will.
If you want to think of another team of director and politician, the obvious counterpart is Adolf Hitler and Leni Riefenstahl. Triumph of the Will is a collaboration. Yes, Riefenstahl was a director, but Hitler was the leading star. He wrote his own dialogue. He was a choreographer. He designed the props. He designed the set. And they worked absolutely magnificently together in that they understood each other. They had the same political and artistic agenda. And the only team that could have countered them effectively as propagandists was Churchill and Korda.
Russia, Italy, Germany all had a very clear, very well-funded propaganda campaign producing films that were in the national interest. Britain's attitude, by comparison, was amateur. It was still based in the idea that gentlemen didn't boast.
Korda felt very similarly about the Nazi threat to peace in Europe. There was a meeting of minds.
The private life of Henry VIII, 1933.
Cromwell, if England were as rich as Portugal, as big as Spain, you might be right. But this little island of 3 million souls is no match for all Europe.
All Europe?
Yes, if those French and Germans stop cutting each other's throats, what's to stop them cutting ours?
Well, why is diplomacy, sir?
Diplomacy, diplomacy, me foot! I'm an Englishman. I can't say one thing and mean another. What I can do is to build ships, and then more ships.
You mean double the fleet?
Triple it! Fortify Dover! Rule the sea!
To do this will cost us money, sire.
To leave it undone will cost us England.
I had a performance down here over the weekend. Henry VIII, I consider a magnificent production, fully deserving of the great success it has achieved. My only criticism would be a little less chicken bone chewing and a little more England building.
He found a perfect partner in Korda, who also understood this iconography and branding of Britain, if you like.
Korda really is someone who helped invent the idea of the English gentleman.
Korda turned next to the Scarlet Pimpernel. Here, an English gentleman is seen secretly winning the war against the persecutions of the French Revolution by masking his identity.
Well?
The Pimpernel was played by an actor who came to embody the quintessential English gentleman, Leslie Howard. But Howard was another outsider. He was born Leslie Howard Steiner and was a fellow Hungarian.
Lend a hand!
Look, Marguerite. England.
I think in a way Churchill and Korda were soulmates in the respect that they were both deeply patriotic people, Korda in terms of his borrowed patriotism, Churchill in the sense that he had a rich history.
A huge part of Churchill's self-conscious knowledge of himself was that he was part of history. As a descendant of John Churchill, the first Duke of Marlborough.
What a century it's been. Marlborough rode to war, and Washington crossed the Delaware. Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. The last of the Stuarts. Peter the Great. Voltaire. Clive of India. Bonaparte.
Nelson.
Lady Hamilton, 1941.
In September, he and Corder had lunch, and he offered Churchill a £10,000 advance, and within a week or 10 days, he'd produced a 7,000-word scenario, as he called it, or screenplay. And he reported to his wife, Clementine, that Corder was delighted with it.
Churchill, with his screenplay, is really painting a picture of the British Empire. He wants to tell its story.
Field picture to be serious. Massive appreciation of England and her empire. We have unrivaled opportunity.
He was making scenarios, he was having conversations with Lajos Biro, who was called a scriptwriter, for weeks about how things would be done. And he had some very interesting ideas about using animation to make clear the rather more subtle matters of foreign policy.
I want you to type out the details of the scenario of my play, The Reign of George V. Flash to a trumpeter comes into the picture against the sky. The drum roll ceases and the heralds proclaim His Majesty King George V. Scene, rapid series of shots of all parts of the empire. At the time, August 1911. Then suddenly, the crisis came. Scene, a small German gunboat, the Panther, steaming through the water on a moonlight night. More shipbuilding scenes. On the wires, several shapeless objects with seaweed. At medium distance, they might be rocks. But as these objects are brought close up, it resolves itself into a dead man in uniform. This terrifying spectacle is our only macabre shot. Exterior shot, battlefield, day. In all her wars, England has always gained one battle, the last, and then blackout.
Churchill was clearly imagining British history on an epic scale, and it would have cost a fortune.
The film never got made, but Churchill got handsome compensation from London Film Productions, and he was delighted with that. And it was very, very helpful to him in 1935, when he was very short of money.
The real moment of moral courage and testing, I think, must have been those long years in the wilderness in the 30s, when he could count on the fingers of one hand his close friends and supporters.
As soon as you have anything to show me, I should like to come to the studio and see the pictures.
Denham was an extraordinary studio. It was built on the largest possible scale. Churchill used his connections so that the pond at Denham could be stocked with swans, which needed the permission of the king.
This was something fabulous for those days and a complete change in our ideas about British filmmaking. It had never been done or attempted before. Here was something that was glamorous and sophisticated and cosmopolitan and world-wise. And it was presided over by this great Hungarian princeling, Alexander Korda. It must have made the same sort of effect on us that the reign of John Kennedy, when he came into the White House.
He came in and became an equal partner in United Artists, you know, with Chaplin and Fairbanks and Pickford and D.W. Griffith.
This is a studio where you can make movies that you can sell around the world.
Whilst Corder was becoming more powerful by the day, Churchill was being cast further into the wilderness. His constant attacks on the government's policy of appeasing Germany were making him an outcast.
The government, the big press combines, are conspiring with each other to suppress criticism of the government and of appeasement. The Chamberlain government spoke to newspaper publishers and said, let's not give him any more oxygen. And the Nazi government put pressure on European publishers, even in countries they had not invaded yet, and told them, well, there are going to be consequences if you publish Churchill. Churchill felt that his own freedom as a writer, which was terribly important to him, which was at the very core of his identity, was under threat. But he was able to provide some of the shall we say, political scaffolding of someone else's screenplay. That I think he was very good at.
The romantic idea of Britain was 1588 and the Armada.
Yeah, Mussolini always said the British are pushovers. They're not like Francis Drake anymore, the Sea Dogs and the buccaneers of the Elizabethan era.
Fire over England, 1937.
For I am England.
And I am the voice of Spain.
Continue, voice of Spain.
Fire Over England is another allegorical story of importance of defending England against possible invasion. Everyone at this time is aware of Germany rearming.
The need to produce and maintain a strong navy becomes a coded way of talking about air rearmament.
See, here lies England, but half an island, not 300 miles long, nor 200 miles broad. How small we are, how wretched and defenseless.
And here we have Queen Elizabeth, this immensely powerful figurehead, leading the nation into war.
Gentlemen, dear Micah, if you took seven little ships and tarred them and piled them with firewood and so sailed out single-handed against the greatest fleet the world has ever known, if you took not swords in your hands but torches...
For Churchill, Corder was the personality he saw in the Great Crisis, which I think Churchill knew was coming, might be the very person to make the movies that would promote the cause.
Very much in his mind the whole time was how to get the situation home to the Americans, because they had this defeatist ambassador, Joe Kennedy, in London, who was a disaster. And everything possible had to be done to stiffen the American resolve.
A huge amount of anti-British propaganda was going on in America.
There were a certain number of Americans who really hated Britain, particularly as represented by Winston Churchill. He was an old-fashioned man who, some of us thought, was not a real Democrat with a little D at heart. British had maintained their colonies for years, and obviously Winston Churchill was loath to give them up. The outstanding example in my mind is Colonel Robert McCormick, who owned the Chicago Tribune, a very important and rich newspaper. He was a very important and rich man. He felt that British imperialism was more dangerous than Hitler's fascism. He didn't want to give any aid to Britain, aid whatever.
While the British Empire is being roundly criticized in the American political arena, in Hollywood, it's depicted in absolutely heroic terms. The film The Four Feathers, which, of course, Corder was involved in, is a film glorifying the British Empire.
So this is 1938, and also made it under the most impossible international conditions. To send a film team to the Sudan at that time must have seemed crazy.
It came from an actual experience of Churchill's. He was in a cavalry charge at Omdurman, which is an event depicted in that film.
It's famously about this chap, Harry Faversham, who comes from a very military family indeed, and all his family have been generals. And indeed, there's a marvellous performance by C. Aubrey Smith. The walnuts are the Russian guns here.
Here, these nuts were the Russians. Guns, guns, guns. On the right, the British infantry. The thin red line. There was the commander-in-chief. And here was I, at the head of the old 68th. The right was impossible, the left was blocked. Behind us was the commander-in-chief. I realized the position in a flash. I said, the 68th will move forward. Immediately, one of my subalterns came to me, shaking. Absolutely shaking. I said, what's wrong, Travers? I'm afraid to face those guns, sir. I said, would you rather face me? He took one look at my face and off he went. 10 minutes later, he was shot to pieces at the head of his men. As a soldier should be, eh?
I quite agree with you, General. I can tolerate nerves before a battle, but I can't stand cowardice.
But you can see this boy being terrified. And so he doesn't join up when all his friends do to go to a war in Africa. They all send him a white feather, which is the symbol of cowardice. But then, of course, he goes in undercover and shows exemplary bravery and saves them all.
Can you tell me where you're going? Egypt.
In the movie, the phrase Suakim on the Red Sea appears on the screen.
The Four Feathers comes out in April 1939 with a very timely message, because it's only a few months later that war breaks out.
Churchill's predictions about Nazi aggression had been proved right. His wilderness years were now over, and he was offered the position of the First Lord of the Admiralty. But it was not long before the public began to call for him to lead the nation.
The way Churchill becomes Prime Minister is itself a Hollywood story. He's almost the last person who could have become Prime Minister. In this extraordinary way, he finds himself now centre stage.
Corder promised Churchill that if war was declared, the next day he would turn the whole of Denham's resources over to making a propaganda film and have it out within 1 month. In return, he asked that the British film industry should be regarded as an essential war weapon. He got his agreement.
The title, The Lion Has Wings, was really wishful thinking. So Corder had to make them seem bigger and more impressive than they actually were.
Once again, second to none. Ready for anything, no matter how difficult and dangerous. Britain founded her greatness on the sea. The spirit of those great names of old lives once more in those who dare the uncharted heights of heaven. Nelson, Drake, Frobisher, Raleigh. Dauntless courage that made them famous is born anew in these young captains of the clouds. German pursuit planes were shaken off. The flight of bombers returned home. And although you have been watching a reconstruction of that raid upon the Kiel Canal, the men you now see stepping out of these bombers are the officers and men of the RAF who actually carried out that heroic raid. These are the men who flew the planes and dropped the bombs on Hitler's battleship.
France has now been defeated, and despite the propaganda and confusion of recent months, it is now obvious that England is losing war. I believe...
Winston realized right from the beginning that the only thing that matters was to get the Americans into the war on our side, and therefore he was prepared to go to great lengths to woo the president.
My father could no more have brought America into the war than fly to the moon, because he had to have the American people behind him, and they weren't about to. If you remember back in those days, we used to have an organization called America First.
May 1940, Britain's in trouble. France has fallen. So this is the point where using propaganda in the most effective way has become critical. The challenge is how best to use Corder. The best way to use Corder is to send him to Hollywood, to the movie capital.
Churchill understood if he could make Englishness there on the screen, it could woo America and draw them into the war.
And it's at this point that Corder has a meeting with Duff Cooper, who is Churchill's Minister of Information. And I think it's at that meeting that the idea of making Lady Hamilton is first broached. And the idea, one feels, must have come from Churchill.
He was sitting up in bed in a great quilted dressing gown, puffing at a cigar with some papers, and curled up at the bottom of the bed, a magnificent black cat. And after a bit of this, he suddenly said, "Poor pussy." And he looked up at me. He said, "He's just had a very painful operation. His name is Nelson."
He had a bust of Nelson on his desk.
resistance to Napoleon is part of the national story of a lot of European peoples, including the Russians.
And that was basically what the threat of Germany was. And we'd done it alone before, and we may have to do it again, but we would want America's support. We want them to buy into this romantic view.
Korda is lucky to have within his stable, I guess, two of the most successful and certainly the biggest movie star in the world after Gone with the Wind, Vivian Leigh. These two huge stars who, of course, had their own real-life romance behind the on-screen romance.
One day at the beginning of the war, when my husband and I were playing in New York, we got a message from Alex asking us if we would make a film about Nelson and Lady Hamilton. The object of the enterprise was, quite frankly, indirect propaganda. So off we obediently flew to Hollywood. Time was short and money was scarce.
Olivier, who was probably the only actor who could embody glory.
We were persuaded by sort of ambassadorial circles that the thing to do was to stay there and keep the English face on the screen and remind the Americans that we're English people. My argument was, yes, they might say this, nice face, strong teeth and all that, but what's it doing on the screen? Why isn't it over there shooting a gun?
And other film producers criticized Korda heavily for leaving Britain.
The crux of the whole war. A radio speech, September 11th, 1940, London.
Therefore, we must regard the next week or so as a very important week for us in our history. It ranks with the days when the Spanish Armada was approaching the Channel and Drake was finishing his game of bowls, or when Nelson stood between us and Napoleon's Grand Army at Boulogne. We've read about all this in the history books. But what is happening now is on a far greater scale and of far more consequence to the life and future of the world and its civilization than these brave old days of the past.
For us British producers, no success can be as important and satisfying as the success you, the great American movie-going public, can give us. We were lucky to have Miss Vivian Leigh, our great artist, to play the chief part in this picture.
Cable Corner at General Services Studios, Hollywood. Would not Emma be a better title?
If there were more Emmas, there would be more Nelsons.
The British title was Lady Hamilton. In America, it was called That Hamilton Woman.
If ever a picture was made to make money, it's That Hamilton Woman. With a heaven-sent piece of casting that brings together the world's most publicized couple in a big, important hit, personally directed by Alexander Korda, working for the first time with the unlimited facilities of American production close at hand, everybody in the trade is already gossiping about That Hamilton Woman. John Chapman, New York Daily News columnist, writes, Miss Leigh has done the nearly impossible. She has topped her performance in Gone with the Wind.
I don't think a woman can be at her best playing the fool with news of war.
Oh, don't think about it, my dear. Wars are sordid, ugly things. There's no need for them to bother you.
Milady, your dancing master's here. Shall I show him to the dancing room?
No, send him away.
But Emma...
I don't feel like dancing. William, you've left certain gaps in my education. This war, for instance. I know nothing about it.
Yes, but my dear, why...
Well, every time I ask you a serious question, you begin shuffling about. Tell me about it. How did it happen?
It's very dull, my dear.
I don't care how dull it is. I want to know.
Well, here's England.
Such a tiny little bit. Where are we?
Here at Naples.
But why should England fight?
Well, because all through these centuries, she has built up a commonwealth in which every little spot has its purpose and value to the balanced line of life. And there are always men who, for the sake of their insane ambition, want to destroy what other people build. And therefore, this tiny little bit, as you call it, Emma, has to send out its ships again and again to fight those who want to dictate their will to others.
Then came 5 years of war. We fought alone with no allies. The whole of Europe in deadly fear of Napoleon Bonaparte. Nothing between him and the conquest of the world but a few ships. And Nelson.
The picture became a tremendous success, and later it became the favorite picture of Winston Churchill, who I understand saw it 8 times and cried every time.
The whole story of Lady Hamilton, it touched him tremendously. He knew Vivian Leigh. He loved and admired her whenever he saw her.
Alex Gorder gave him the film, and he played it over and over again, and he just thought it was so beautiful.
They'd already seen Lady Hamilton, and they were having very high-level strategic discussions. And at a certain point in the evening, 9 or 10 o'clock, Churchill said, I don't want to have this discussion anymore. Let's have that Lady Hamilton film again. They checked and found that the van with all of the equipment and the operators and the film and the projectors was on its way back to London, and there was a move, put roadblocks out in order to stop them and send them back again because the Prime Minister wants to see the film again.
A fascinating thing is how Churchill now becomes the movie star. Churchill becomes a kind of Corder character himself.
I think that there was something in Churchill that wanted to be a hero. And when the opportunity came at long last in his life, he was ready, almost as an actor, he was ready to be the great man.
A very typical pose of his was a pause in what he was doing. And a large box of matches with very large matches taken out, a big match struck, a big flame coming from it, and the cigar being relit. But the cigars often went out because there was a certain amount of damp coming into them, since they were used as a sort of a prop.
That V sign and the cigar and the, you know, the hat, the Homburgs and other hats that he wore and the bow tie, all of these things, he knew what was expected. And whether these stories about him actually taking his teeth out when speaking on the wireless so that his voice was very distinctive, whether they're true or not, almost doesn't matter, because it's all part of the myth that he was able to build up about himself. And what's fascinating is how aware he was of this side to politics, the showboating side, from an early age, from when he, as he put it, stepped from a latrine into the public stage because he escaped by the lavatories from the prison of war camp in South Africa. So it was an extraordinary, you know. And so even from those early days, he knew that there was this thing to be had. And what was marvellous is he could carry it across to the country itself, to a national sense of branding, not just his own.
Well, look at Queen Elizabeth I. She showed herself to the people on her annual progresses, much as Churchill did when he went to the bomb sites in London. She made herself very visible. She knew that governing a people was largely a matter of performance. And there's her famous speech at Tilbury when the Spanish Armada was on the way, or actually the Spanish Armada at that point was scurrying for home.
My people. I am come to live or die amongst you all, to lay down for my God and for my kingdom and for my people, my honor and my blood, even in the dust. I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and valor of a king, and of a king of England, too. Not Spain nor any prince of Europe shall dare to invade the borders of my realm. Pluck up your hearts. By your peace in camp, and your valor in the field, we shall shortly have a famous victory.
I would say, up there with William Shakespeare, she was probably the best performer of that era. And then Churchill comes along and says, these days are as great as the era of the Spanish Armada, because we are facing a similar crisis, and we're living through it. We're making this story, all of us.
Now, the old lion with her lion cubs at her side stands alone against hunters who are armed with deadly weapons and impelled by desperate and destructive rage. Is the tragedy to repeat itself once more? Ah, no. This is not the end of the tale. The stars in their courses proclaim the deliverance of mankind. Not so easily shall the onward progress of the peoples be barred. Not so easily shall the lights of freedom die. But time is short. Every month that passes adds to the length and to the perils of the journey that will have to be made. United we stand, divided we fall. Divided, the dark ages return. United, we can save and guide the world.
When the Nazis invaded Russia, Churchill gave a speech on the radio justifying Britain's aid to Russia. He said, I see millions of Russians defending their homeland. I see millions of Russians praying. It's a series of scenes that he's flashing in front of the minds of his listeners. It is very cinematic.
His invasion of Russia is no more than a prelude to an attempted invasion of the British Isles. And that then the scene will be clear for the final act, without which all his conquests would be in vain, namely the subjugation of the Western Hemisphere to his will and to his system. I see the Russian soldiers standing on the threshold of their native land, guarding the fields which their fathers have tilled from time immemorial. I see them guarding their homes, where mothers and wives pray. Ah, yes, for there are times when all pray for the safety of their loved ones, for the return of the breadwinner, of the champion, of their protector. I see also the dull, drilled, docile, brutish masses of the Hun soldiery plodding on like a swarm of crawling locusts. And behind all this glare, behind all this storm, I see that small group of villainous men who plan, organize, and launch this cataract of horrors upon mankind.
We return you now to Hollywood.
It was always the greatest fun to work with Alex. He had the most extraordinary understanding and sympathy for actors. But it was most exciting at the times when his back was against the wall, as in this instance. It was then that he showed all his very finest qualities. His great hero, Churchill, caused it to be shown to him on several occasions. Not the least noteworthy of these was on board HMS Prince of Wales during the Great Atlantic Charter Meeting in August 1941.
That meeting was probably as important a meeting as was ever held by two heads of state at any time in war or in peace.
And I think it's part of Churchill's sense of drama that this film about a British naval hero should be seen on a British warship. And you can see how that would have appealed to Churchill.
Mr. Churchill had cinema shows. This is a funny thing. You know, you get a screen hung up in the middle of the room. If you go and sit at the other side, the film's different. It's in reverse.
Churchill invited a writer to be present at the screening, a person called H.V. Morton. He gives a very powerful account of what happened.
Imagine the scene. We were in the wardroom of a battleship at sea, and the audience was composed of officers who had recently taken the ship into action. As in Nelson's day, England was again at war, fighting for her life.
Mr. Pascoe, I will now amuse the fleet with a signal. Mr. Pascoe, I wish to say to the fleet, England confides that every man will do his duty. You must be quick, for I have one more to follow, which is the close action.
An English flag is raised.
England.
Reading from the Atlantic Meeting by H.V. Morton.
Winston Churchill was completely absorbed in the story and for the first time spoke no longer to those near him, but seemed to retreat into himself, as if he was sitting alone in the dark, expressing an attention so complete that it seemed one might look and find him no longer there, but taken up, merged and absorbed by the screen. Then, as the last scene came, and Nelson lay dying in the cockpit of the Victory, they bent over him and told him that the day was his. The man who was watching so intently took a handkerchief from his pocket and wiped his eyes without shame. Looking at Winston Churchill at that revealing moment, I thought that in some extraordinary way, he belongs to an older England, to the England of the Tudors, a violent, swashbuckling England, perhaps, but a warm and emotional England, too, an England as yet untouched by the hardness of an age of steel.
His plan was magnificent. He swung our fleet from line of battle into two spearheads that broke the enemy line into three separate parts. Then, about 1:30, I was walking with him on the upper deck. The fighting was at its height. The French flagship, the Redoutable, came through the smoke, and we fought alongside one another. He was so confident. We'd just turned to go back to the... He lived to know that he'd won England's greatest victory. His last thoughts were with you, milady. But you should be cared for.
And then?
Then what?
What happened after?
There is no then. There is no after.
She collapses.
The lights went up. We were all, I think, intensely moved in our different ways. Mr. Churchill stood facing us, but this time he did not smile, bow, and depart. He spoke in a grave and quiet voice, so quiet that those at the back of the room had to listen carefully to catch his words. I thought this would interest you, gentlemen, many of whom have recently been engaged with the enemy in matters of equal historical importance. Good night. He bowed and went out.
Some 5,000 men who were within a matter of months to be dead when the Prince of Wales was sunk.
He could give him no reassurance except that we would do our best to advance aid in the form of military supplies and equipment.
America was meant to be neutral at the time. Corder became a very public target.
If any of these groups, the British, the Jewish, or the administration, stops agitating for war, I believe there will be little danger of our involvement. When hostilities commenced in Europe in 1939, it was realized by these groups that the American people had no intention of entering the war. But they believed that this country could be enticed into the war in very much the same way that it was enticed into the last one. Our theaters soon became filled with plays portraying the glory of war.
For the attention of J. Edgar Hoover, Director, FBI, violation by Alexander Korda Films of Section 601, Title 22, United States Code, in acting as an agent for the British government. The New York field office is requested to make discreet inquiry through reliable motion picture informants in an effort to ascertain Korda's activities in New York City and the probable date of his departure for Los Angeles. Confidential informant also stated Korda is quite active in political and social circles in England and mentioned that he is personally acquainted with Winston Churchill and Lord Halifax.
There was a Senate committee which was actually put in place to charge Jetney Corder with sort of un-American activities, as it were.
The American government investigates Hollywood for propaganda in motion pictures. September 9th to 26th, 1941.
Corder found himself in a very, very difficult, dangerous situation. He was being accused by the Senate of warmongering.
You may proceed, Senator Clark.
These are pictures which have
propaganda carefully built up. Let me give you an example of that. I might take that Hamilton woman. Now, the big propaganda moment in this picture comes when, in the midst of these wars between England and various continental countries and Napoleon, Napoleon offers peace to England. And at this point, Nelson comes home and he delivers a speech, a regular 1941 war speech. He delivers it to the Admiralty, but he is actually delivering it to the audience. And the whole purpose of the speech is, you can't make peace with a dictator. It is an argument propagandizing that idea, and it is delivered with all the skill of an able actor after a build-up by the dramatization of the screen.
Churchill is said to have written that scene, and it's easy to imagine that he might have done.
Years ago, I said the same thing at Naples. I begged them, I entreated them not to give way, but they wouldn't listen to me, and they paid the price. That was a little kingdom, miles away in the Mediterranean. But now it is England, our own land. Napoleon can never be master of the world until he has smashed us up. And believe me, gentlemen, he means to be master of the world. You cannot make peace with dictators. You have to destroy them, wipe them out. Gentlemen, I implore you, speak to the Prime Minister before it is too late. Do not ratify this peace.
We appreciate all you say.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I felt it my duty to tell you of these things. I'm not a statesman, of course. I'm no diplomat.
Now that is a pure piece of propaganda in that picture. Nevertheless, I thought the picture was otherwise a fine picture, very beautifully produced, although I have seen reviews to the contrary.
You refer to both Chaplin and Korda. Korda is the head of United Artists now?
According to the newspapers a short time ago, I saw that he was named head of the United Artists. Yes.
The Four Feathers had been an immensely successful movie in America, but it was a pro-British film, and it became part of the attack.
At the beginning of one of the recent colossal creations called Four Feathers, the film began to go completely straight in its undivided admiration of the ancient British sport of knocking off the natives. And this time, the Fuzzy Wuzzies were not permitted to break the British square. It was all pip-pip and tawny port and a thin red line of heroes. The dervishes went down like duck pins under the barrage conducted by a few English generals and their Cockney subalterns. I do not know whether there is any design in all that, but I do not think we ought to allow an instrument of propaganda of such tremendous power to be dominated by people whose point of view cannot possibly be the American point of view.
There was a curious and interesting change in opinion, I felt. I think there was an admiration, a secret perhaps, admiration. At the same time, there was criticism. And of course, those of us who knew what was going on always admired his manipulative powers. He was a great manipulator and worked with another great manipulator, Franklin Roosevelt.
Almost like a Hollywood movie, he finds himself saved in the nick of time.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced.
December 7th, 1941.
And then, of course, what completed the thing was that the Germans proceeded to declare war on America. They might, if they had not, it would have been very awkward because the Americans then would have switched the whole of their equipment, no doubt, to the Pacific. But as it was, they then agreed with us that the first enemy to be defeated was Germany.
I feel greatly honored that you should have invited me to enter the United States Senate chamber and address the representatives of both branches of Congress. And that here I am, an Englishman, welcomed in your midst, makes this experience one of the most moving and thrilling in my life, which is already long and has not been entirely uneventful. I wish indeed that my mother, whose memory I cherish across the veil of years, could have been here to see. By the way, I cannot help reflecting that if my father had been American and my mother British, instead of the other way around, I might have got here on my own.
He glances around as they applaud.
In the end, it was his books and his speeches that really brought Churchill to America. But I don't think he could have really broken through to that American audience without the groundwork done by Corder's films. That communicated Churchill's ideas and themes to America at a time when they were not hospitably received, but ultimately broke through that distrust.
It is not given to us to peer into the mysteries of the future. Still I avow my hope and faith, sure and inviolate, that in the days to come, the British and American peoples will, for their own safety and for the good of all, walk together in majesty, in justice, and in peace.
Churchill takes a seat as he receives a standing ovation.
260 men and women awaiting their turn to receive decorations and honors for bravery or honorable service. One of the biggest investitures for some time, and certainly the most unusual. Film producer Alexander Korda gets a knighthood. His wife, Myrna Oberon, accompanies him.
First time a film producer had ever been knighted.
A Korda, middle of the war, getting a knighthood. It's a reward for that kind of inspiration to Churchill. The films nourish the strategy and the drive to win the war, and conversely, the drive to win the war feeds into the films and gives the films a special meaning.
And back in London, there were a few hours for relaxation. A visit to the cinema was just a brief let-up in the years of almost non-stop toil.
In the final years of the Second World War, Germany is losing on every front. Joseph Goebbels devotes enormous resources to making a film called Kohlberg. It's the most expensive Technicolor film ever made in Nazi Germany. And it's about a small German town heroically resisting Napoleon during the French Wars. Goebbels had to demobilize two divisions of troops to play extras for these spectacular battle scenes. It is premiered January of 1945, the 12th anniversary of the Third Reich. Germany is being invaded on every front. And it actually does, at least momentarily, raise morale. And it is a hypnotizing and an effective film. Of course, a few days after the film, Kohlberg was released, the actual town of Kohlberg fell to the Red Army. But that's how much Goebbels had invested in the whole idea of propaganda and film propaganda.
These media, they come and go, they rise and fall, but they have a glory moment. World War II, I think, is the glory moment for the movies.
Thousands of people in the street. Victory in Europe. House of Commons, May 8th, 1945.
Advance, Britannia! Long live the cause of freedom! God save the King!
Dear Mr. Churchill, I found everything of worth in my life in England. Home, people to love and respect, friends. I lived an alien wherever I have worked anchorless since I left my native country. I have regained that anchor through my love for England. Now that His Majesty the King has given me this great honor through you, whom I admire more than anyone, I must cast aside whatever etiquette might forbid me from thanking you. I know that whatever services I could or will be able to do for our country cannot ever be enough. I was thinking of Browning's poem of Trafalgar the other day. Here and here has England helped me. Where can I help England? Say. Yours respectfully, Alexander Korda.
Individuals mattered. creative individuals mattered. And as in a film or as in a novel, the individual can make a difference. That was his approach to politics. Nothing is fated, nothing is inevitable. Everything hangs in the balance.
Sometimes that thing we can haul out of our dressing up box in case of crisis makes us a more lovable nation than we would otherwise seem to our allies or potential allies. And although his name isn't as well known as it should be, I'm always proud every year that I've been presenting the BAFTA Awards that the best British film is the Alexander Korda Award. And I hope that whoever wins it, even if they didn't know much about Korda, would be minded to look him up and find out about this extraordinary man.
He'd bought, during the war or soon after it, five separate sets of film rights. One of Churchill's books, My Early Life, in 1941. My African Journey, Savrola, Churchill's novel, and River War. Then he took the History of the English-Speaking Peoples, £50,000, which is today's equivalent of £2 million or so. Only one was ever made, and that was 30 years later. And so I've often wondered about why Korda kept on buying these film rights. Was it a disguised gesture of generosity towards Churchill? There's definitely an era of mystery around it.
And by return mail came a letter from Alexander Korda saying, but I do want to give you a substantial gift, so I've decided to give you a cinema. Sure enough, the arrangements were made. There was a room at Chartwell down in the basement. I was given a list by the Korda office, and I would pick out the films. I would choose historical films that he'd always liked. I don't think we tried to move into the new world.
The gift that he had of producing wonderful films, national films, where did he find that within months of arriving in Britain? It is the fascination. Churchill talked about the Soviet Union as a myth wrapped up in an enigma or something along those lines. I think he could have been talking about Korda.
He could have done more than movies, which was why he came along at a good time. The fact that Britain was at war and it was in peril, it gave him an opportunity to show that he could be more than just a movie maker.
And although Churchill was a politician too, he was something more. Part of that moreness was the sort of quality we would now call cinematographic. It's something just bigger and brighter than life. It breaks frame and it touches us in a way that only really that mixture of image and music and drama that is cinema can do. And so there's something very natural about that relationship between Korda and Churchill.
You want to do it all again?
I mean, it's all right for a film star, but I'm not then. Mr. Churchill, scene 7, take 1.